Good evening. It's good to be back with you. My name is Nathaniel Jeanson, in case you weren't here 2 weeks ago. I actually attend here. I usually go to Rocky Sunday School and such. Well, that will probably change since I'm starting in the nursery. But so last week we talked about, I should mention too, I work for the Institute for Creation Research, which is a creation evolution apologetics organization. We exist to equip the church to defend Genesis from attacks from unbelievers and from evolutionists, to encourage the church to put their full confidence in the beginning of Scripture. And our main focus is the church, although any evangelistic consequences we have, of course, are great. And so last week we covered the nature of science, used some examples from human-chimp similarities, some hot topics that you might hear on the news or in NOVA, if you pay any attention to those things. This week's going to be a little different. We're going to talk about stem cells in the Bible, which isn't really an origins issue, but it is a Bible science issue that is very relevant to you, hot topic in the news, maybe relevant to your health and to the health of those around you, may have been relevant to the health of people you know already. And the reason I'm talking about this, even though, this, like I said, this isn't really an Institute for Creation Research topic, is I did my PhD in stem cells, worked on adult stem cells, blood stem cells, back in Harvard and Boston. Actually got to be a panelist for the Massachusetts Citizens for Life State Convention to talk about stem cells. Was able to submit testimony to the Massachusetts state legislator when they were trying to overturn some more pro-life laws. I actually worked for a guy who would go on national television, his name is David Skadden, to argue for embryonic stem cell research, so we basically had opposite positions. But we had a good relationship about this. We met in the State House once to argue opposite sides of the issue, and but even through that, we were able to maintain a good relationship. So what I want to cover tonight is really more of a medical ethics question than an origins one, but I trust it will be useful to you. So the big question I want to address tonight is this one. Is it morally acceptable to use stem cells for research and medicine? And I apologize, I don't have a pointer. My high laser beam disappears whenever it hits the screen. And one other thing I need to apologize for, I don't have any handouts tonight or any booklets or things you could take with you. Some of the views I'm going to present, I think, are even a little different than some of the major pro-life organizations. I tend to take a little bit more conservative approach, and I currently don't have anything written up, so hopefully I'll go through it slowly. You'll be able to take good notes, and I think it would be helpful to you and helpful to me if you just stop me in case I don't explain something well. I'd rather repeat it three times than lose half the audience. So this is the main question that I want to address and try to answer. And before we can answer this question, we really need to address a bigger question, and that's namely, do I have to point it? Okay. When does life begin? And a lot of people don't want to answer this question. A lot of my colleagues at Harvard tried to avoid answering this question, and by the way, Harvard is probably one of the biggest stem cell centers there is in Boston. And a lot of people would object if we used the Bible to try to answer this question. And they shouldn't, and you shouldn't feel ashamed to use the Scripture to answer this question, because this is not a scientific question. It's a religious and philosophical question, which means you have to use a religious and philosophical answer. Anyone who pretends that they have the scientific answer doesn't understand the nature of the question. Any answer someone else gives is going to be their own philosophical or moral view based on some presuppositions. So you shouldn't feel ashamed to use Scripture to answer this. Then, of course, the bigger question is which one is right, and I won't. We of course know which one is right. I'm not going to deal with how do you interact in the public sphere as a believer. That's a larger question we don't have time to cover tonight. So I'm going to answer this with Scripture because it's appropriate to do so. And furthermore, just a note on the nature of science as it relates to medical ethics. Science can't answer this. It can only describe. It can tell you when, at what time, and what chemical reactions happen, let's say, when the sperm fertilizes the egg, or the number of cell divisions that has to happen before you reach implantation, or some of these stages. And those are all well and good and important to know, but those events don't come with labels that say life. You apply a label based on your moral and philosophical view to that scientific event. So you don't need to be a PhD in science or anything to be able to answer this question or apply it well, because it's not a scientific one. So the biblical answer, I'll use two passages to justify the view I'm going to use throughout this talk. First one is from Luke 1. You know the story when Elizabeth conceived John the Baptist, and Mary also supernaturally conceived Jesus. Mary went to go visit Elizabeth, and there was a reaction inside of Elizabeth, and this is what she said. When Elizabeth heard the greeting of Mary, the babe leaped in her womb, and Elizabeth says to Mary, as soon as the voice of your greeting sounded in my ears, the babe leaped in my womb for joy. Notice it doesn't say that the blob of tissue in her womb leaped for joy, or a cluster of cells in her womb leaped for joy, or an extension of her uterus leaped for joy. It says, the baby, meaning clearly John the Baptist. So this passage at least teaches that life is life in the embryonic stage. And if someone is pessimistic or a little persnickety, they might say, well, this just teaches that at later development, I think it's pretty obvious that there's life there. You can see the limbs, the head, the eyes, the legs. So that's obvious. Where stem cell research, this is different. This is really early when it doesn't look like a human being. So what's the scriptural answer to that? So here's the penitential psalm of David that he wrote after his sinning with Bathsheba. And he says, behold, I was brought forth in iniquity, and in sin my mother conceived me. Notice what it doesn't say. It doesn't say, in sin my mother conceived the blob of tissue that became me. Or in sin my mother conceived a fetus that developed over 9 months of time and then gave birth to me. David was me. David was a human being from the moment of conception. Total depravity. Sinful from conception. And this does not mean, as one of my professors in the stem cell class says, sin is not here sex. Clearly that's commanded before sin ever enters the world. Be fruitful and multiply. And by the way, the medical ethicists in the secular world are probably the hardest to deal with. I actually raised my hand. I said, he was trying to argue that the Bible doesn't teach life begins at conception, or the Bible doesn't say when life begins. And I brought this up. He said, no, that's talking about sex or something. So watch out for people who have PhDs, who call themselves ethicists, and who want to tell you what the Bible really says, because they clearly have no idea. So life begins clearly at conception. That is the right answer. That is the philosophical, moral answer. We know the scripture is true. So this is what you should be thinking and believing. So now we can rephrase our big question from this one. Well, we can at least give a partial answer to this question. Is it morally acceptable to use stem cells for research in medicine? Well, if stem cell research in medicine destroys human life, then it's clearly wrong. It's murder. So we can rephrase that question and try to answer a different one. Does stem cell research destroy human life? That's the main question. To know whether or not it's morally acceptable. And so I'm going to cover three different elements of the talk. I should mention, this is just sort of the tip of the iceberg, obviously, for medical ethics. We can't cover everything. Hopefully this will give you a good foundation from which to think about other issues. Furthermore, this field changes so fast, this talk is going to be outdated in a year, likely, because technology just keeps changing like this. And so hopefully this will give you a basis with which to engage other questions as they arise in the future. So first I want to talk about adult stem cells, then cover embryonic stem cells, along the way deal with some of the ethics, and then at the end talk about some recent technological advances that throw some other nuances into this question. So as I mentioned, this is rather complicated, involves a fair amount of biology. I'll try to keep it simple, but pay close attention and hopefully we can follow. So let me start basic high school biology. What's a cell? Anyone? Basic unit of life. Okay, that's good. How many types of cells are there at a basal level? Two, right. So eukaryotic and prokaryotic, basically bacteria and everything else at the basic cell structure level. And we're not going to get more complicated than this, so don't worry. So this is basically bacteria, the prokaryotic. Eukaryotic is everything else. Every cell in your body is a eukaryotic cell. So how many different types of eukaryotic cells are there? I don't know. There's a whole bunch. I'll just put a couple up here on the board for you. So you have smooth muscle like heart cells. Those are one type of cells. You have neuronal cells like this one. This is an astrocyte. You'll find it in your brain. Looks very different. Doesn't normally look green. That's stained. Here's some connective tissue. This is mouse cells, 3T3 cells. Here's very specialized cells, sperm and egg. Sperm has a flagella so it can move. Very different than some of these other cells that you see right there. And then this is a section of bone marrow. It's rather small. You can't see it too well. Hopefully these arrows will highlight. You can see some of these round disc-shaped cells, maybe a little blurry from back there. Red cells, red blood cells. White cells here are actually purple because it's stained. But normally if you don't stain them, they're white. The big ovals there are fat cells that exist in your bone marrow, and then megakaryocytes, this big one there that makes platelets. So there are all sorts of cells, and these cells together form the tissues, the diverse tissues of your body. And some of the cells I showed you just in the previous slide form like brain and heart and bone marrow, as I mentioned. And what's fascinating about multicellular creatures, when they reproduce, is they condense, I think we may have talked about this 2 weeks ago, condense all this complexity into a single cell every generation. And from that single cell, they build up you and me. And the key point I want to focus on in this process is the fact that to go from a single cell to you and me requires a whole lot of cell division, because your body has right now has trillions of cells in it. So that has to divide into 2 cells to 4 cells, 8 cells, 16, on and on you go, until you get the slew of cells that exist in your body right now, in your bone marrow right now, as this little diagram shows. So there's a lot of cell division. What's interesting is, once you divide, divide, and divide, and you get all the cells of your adult body, you'd expect cell division to stop. And a lot of cell division does stop, because you're done growing. There are certain cell types that just don't divide at all, period, in the adult. Red blood cells don't even have DNA to divide. They don't have genetic material. Most of your brain cells don't divide. They might form new connections for memory and such, but they don't divide and make more. Your muscle cells, by and large, do not divide and proliferate. So what's the big deal? This wouldn't be a problem. Again, so we've solved the growth problem. We've divided until we've gotten a certain size. So what's the big deal? The problem is, many of your adult cells don't live forever. Right now, some of your white blood cells that were born this morning are dying because they only have a lifespan of 8 hours. Some of your red blood cells are dying right now because they were born 3 months ago and only have a 3-month lifespan. The intestines, the cells of your gut, at least the cells of the gut in the mouse, last all of 2 days. They turn themselves over that fast. Oops. Got to keep pointing it back that way. So that raises the question, why aren't you dying of infection, because that's what white blood cells fight, of suffocation because red blood cells carry oxygen, and of starvation because your gut's sloughing itself off? Now, this isn't a healthy individual, normally happening to you right now. Of course, it gets more complicated if you have an adventurous lifestyle and you bleed or you scrape or you break a bone or something along these lines. Now you've lost cells there too. Why don't we shrink? Why don't more adventurous people shrink over time? So let's use an example like this one. You cut yourself. Paper cut, out drops some blood. Out of that blood comes some cells, some red blood cells. You've lost them. And now they're gone. What is the body going to do to replace those so that you don't keep dying slowly over time? Well, we know that the red blood cells are not going to divide. That's forbidden, because they can't. So what does your body do? How are you going to solve this problem? Well, imagine that in your body there's a cell, not a red blood cell, but let's just call it a two-color cell, because they're red cells and white cells. And this two-color cell can divide such that it gives rise to one red cell and then another of itself. Of course, that red cell is a dead end. It can't divide. But this two-color cell can divide again. Red cell, another one of itself. Red cell, another one of itself. And on it goes. Notice how efficiently this process maintains that progenitor cell, we'll call it, that two-color cell, while replenishing all these lost red cells. So I've just demonstrated the two fundamental properties of stem cells, basically self-renewal and differentiation. This is just how we define stem cells, by these two basic characteristics. If it can make more of itself, and if it can make a different cell type, it's a stem cell. That's an oversimplification of what occurs in your bone marrow and in your bloodstream. It's much more complicated because you have a whole lot more cell types and a very ordered hierarchy that is sort of diagrammed by this image here. You don't need to know all the details. Just know that it's a very ordered and complex hierarchy to maintain all the different cells in your bloodstream. So that's the blood. Anyone recognize this bone? Femur. If you were to divide that and slice it from the top, and look at the inside, it might look like this. If you can see from back there, basically, maybe I'll diagram at my own leg, from here to here, or here to here, if you were to slice it open, it would be basically hollow. hollow in terms of bone. It wouldn't actually be hollow because it would be chock full of cells, your blood cells. And near the ends, the tips, like at the kneecap and up here at the hip, it's more spongy and mesh-like. Not really spongy because it's bone, but it's like a mesh. It's like a net. That's where your blood stem cells occur. And not just in your femur, all over your body, because there are bones all over your body. You have stem cells in your skull, stem cells in your spine, you have stem cells right here. Now, stem cells are useful in medicine. You may know people have gotten a bone marrow transplant. That's a stem cell transplant. Now, where would you want to harvest stem cells if you were trying to do a stem cell transplant? Of course, we have medical people here, I think, so you'll know how to answer this. Where would you want to harvest stem cells from? Okay, that's a good answer. Back in the day, they'd harvest it right here because the bone is close to the surface. You don't want to go in your femur because you have to go through all that skin. You see a problem with sticking a big 18-gauge needle right here, right by the heart. So now they typically do it back here at the hip because, again, the bone is close to the surface. And this is what it might look like if they are taking a stem cell harvest. Stick a big, like, pencil-sized hole right back here, stick a needle in, and then I'm told by the MDs, I didn't actually get to do this, that you know you're in the bone marrow when the patient screams because it's painful. So that's where your stem cells might be. And if you're doing research, you might take that bone marrow sample, stick it in a culture dish like this. They'll float because these normally exist in the blood and they float through your bloodstream. And you stick them in a, you have to do this sterilely, of course. You do this in a hood like this, sterile tissue culture hood. And you could grow them. Now, that's the blood system. And the blood system solves this problem of continual turnover, of white cells turning over every 8 hours, of your red blood cells turning over every 3 months. So you'd expect to find stem cells in tissues where you also have turnover. And, for example, like in the gut, you also find stem cells. So here's just a basic gross anatomy diagram. Let's take a section, let's say, of the gut. Might look like this. Diagrammed it very simply as a hollow tube. If we were to then take a small tissue section of that edge of the gut right there, it's not actually smooth as I've displayed, but rather undulated with valleys and hills and finger-like projections. The valleys we call crypts. The finger-like projections we call villi. That serves a very useful biological purpose, increases the surface area for absorption of food. If you were then to take a section and look through it, it would look like this. You can see the finger-like projections. All those dots are cells. So it's chock full of cells. Stem cells exist in the crypt. That's where you find them, down right about there. And they have the same basic properties of stem cells, give rise to more of themselves and to other cell types. And when they divide, they'll give rise to a stem cell that stays put right there, and another one that moves towards the surface, and near the surface is where you get sloughed off and passed through your digestive system. Skin also is sloughing itself off. So you have stem cells in your skin, in what's called the bulge region. Again, same two properties, self-renewal, differentiation. One stem cell divides, gives rise to another one of itself that stays in the bulge. The other one moves towards the surface and gets sloughed off. It's a different cell type. Now, the fact that stem cells can sustain this turnover of tissue makes them a very attractive candidate to use for therapy. If they normally sustain tissue turnover, it'd be great to be able to use them for, let's say, injury settings or for disease settings like leukemia. So you can transplant bone marrow. And stem cells have been used and would like to be used for a whole variety of different diseases. So bone marrow transplants have been used since the 60s or 70s. People didn't know they were doing stem cell transplants back then, but they were. And so stem cells are being used currently for therapy, and there's a whole bunch of other diseases, obviously, that we'd like to use adult stem cells for. So what's the big deal? Actually, before I get to that, let's stop and ask an ethical question. So does adult stem cell research, let's say harvesting a little bit from the back of your pelvis, take any human life? No. So is it morally acceptable to do adult stem cell research in medicine? Yes, obviously. No problem there. So someone might say, well, use them. Why are people, what's the big fuss? And this is the major problem. Now, if you go on pro-life sites, they'll probably say, adult stem cell research has a lot more success than embryonic. Currently, that's a true statement. But we've been doing it for 40 years. embryonic stem cell stuff we've been doing for about 10. So it's really not a fair comparison. And my prediction is that number's not going to that's going to change in the future. So it's a useful pragmatic argument for the moment, but I don't think it's going to be useful later because theoretically, I'm going to list some of these limitations. Adult stem cells are probably not going to be able to cure all our diseases for a number of reasons. I mentioned the biological purpose of stem cells is to sustain this constant tissue turnover. Well, there's some tissues that don't have constant turnover, like the brain, like the pancreas, like the liver, and we haven't been able to find stem cells in these tissues. So if there are no stem cells in the pancreas, how are you going to treat diabetes? If there's no cell type that keeps dividing and sustaining what you've lost or what your immune system has attacked, someone might say, well, just take some blood stem cells and stick them in the pancreas of the brain to maybe cure Alzheimer's. And the problem with that is most of your adult stem cells make only cells of that tissue. So your blood stem cells are only going to make blood. Your bone stem cells are only going to make bone and so forth. Skin only going to make skin. There was some controversy about a decade ago. People thought you could convert them, and that doesn't seem to be the case. So that's a limitation, a major limitation. Furthermore, stem cells are pretty rare. It's hard to get at them. So we'd like to be able to take a little sample, make it divide, and then give it back to you. Or put it in more practical terms, let's take bone marrow transplants, which, again, is used a lot of. If you have a patient who has leukemia, so that's a blood disorder, ideally you'd like to be able to take out a few good, healthy stem cells, kill the rest of their bone marrow and blood with chemotherapy or radiation, and then put the good ones back in. Well, you need a whole lot of stem cells to keep them alive, and it's hard to get that out from one individual. So what they do is sometimes they'll use cord blood. So when a baby is born, you have the umbilical cord, usually it's just tossed. You can get stem cells from that. So some people will use that. Well, for an adult, you need about two of those. So there's cellular cell number limitations that prevent us from using adult stem cells as much as we want. So that limits their use in transplants. And probably the biggest problem is the fact that I can't give stem cells to you, or you can't give stem cells to a sick individual because their immune system will likely reject yours. Or if you ablate theirs, your immune system might attack them. So unless it's a close sibling, this is a huge hurdle to giving healthy cells to a diseased individual. So what do? You can stop there and try to look for drugs or something like that, or you can look for stem cells from other sources, which is what scientists have done. And this is where embryonic stem cells come in and why people are so excited and where the controversy comes from. And to explain how they're derived, we need to step back and review embryonic development. So you and I began as a single cell when the sperm fertilized the egg and made what we call a zygote. That, of course, to get the trillions of cells that make you, needed to divide a number of times, 2-cell, 4-cell, 8-cell, and so forth. And one intermediate stage, this is hard to see, is what we call the blastocyst stage, this pink stage right here. It's basically a hollow ball of cells. Cells form the outside of the sphere, and inside is this little cluster in light blue that we call the inner cell mass. That's what eventually gives rise to the baby. This blastocyst implants in the uterine wall and then gives rise over 9 months to the fetus and the baby. Now, to harvest embryonic stem cells, they stop at this blastocyst stage. I've changed the diagram slightly, don't be confused. I've just rotated the sphere so now that the inner cell mass is on the bottom. They take this blastocyst, destroy it, take out the inner cell mass, put this in a culture dish, and you get a cluster of cells that looks like that. Okay, yeah, so you stick them in a culture dish. Unlike blood stem cells, they wouldn't float. They'd stick because that's what they normally do. They stick to each other. You do this in a sterile environment, and now you'd get this embryonic stem cell stage. So let's stop here before we discuss the therapeutic potential and just ask an ethical question. Does embryonic stem cell research take human life? Yes. So is it morally acceptable to do embryonic stem cell research? So just to make this very clear, what happens when you destroy the blastocyst? You basically are taking this stage, you're preventing implantation, you're preventing development, and so you've destroyed human life. So it's not morally acceptable. So that should end our discussion very simply. It's wrong. It's murder. And, of course, that hasn't. It's still a hot political question. Why? Because embryonic stem cells solve most of the problems we encounter with adults, at least theoretically. and so people think we should use them. And I'll get to some of the complicated ethical arguments and justifications they use to arrive at this conclusion. So why are they so useful? Well, return to the biology. You're stopping at this stage. This means you're preventing the development of head, brain, pancreas, liver, and all those other tissues that would normally form in the fetus. So you've stopped that development, but you haven't stopped the potential. It still exists in those cells, which means theoretically you can derive pancreas, you can derive liver, you can derive brain, you can derive any cell type you want, because that's what these cells are designed to do. That's what they normally do. They divide and give rise to all the cells of the fetus, which means theoretically we should be able to make any cell type we want and cure any disease we want, because it has this power and potential that, like I said, is normally the way it's normally designed to do. So, the problems we've encountered with adult stem cell research, we can't find them in every tissue. Well, embryonic stem cells solve that. We can make any cell type we want. The problem that we only have a limited developmental potential, well, that's obviously solved too. You can make any cell type you want. Solve problem number two. Adult stem cells don't seem to be able to divide very well when we stick them in culture. We solved that problem because these cells, we found a way to trick them into just dividing forever, indefinitely. The one problem these didn't solve at first is this immune rejection. After all, you've fused sperm and egg, you've started the developmental process, unique individual, unique genetics, unique immune system. It's not a match. That's where you enter cloning, which you might be familiar with. If this small diagram, I apologize. Familiar if you've heard of Dolly the Sheep. So basically the way this happens is you take an egg from one donor, let's say a ewe of one sheep type. Then you take a cell from another sheep, could be any cell, a skin cell, a tongue cell, whatever you want. You take the genetic material from that and stick it in the egg of the donor, and you trick it into thinking it's now a fertilized egg, because after all, it is an egg with a full complement of genetic material, and it begins to divide as a normal embryo would. You'd stick that into a mother, so now she's pregnant, allow it to come to term, and you've got a clone. And it's a clone, it's an exact genetic match of whatever that donor cell type was originally. Whatever the DNA matches, that's what it's a clone of. So Dolly the Sheep is a clone of that type of sheep originally up there. And this is theoretically possible in humans. I don't think anyone's actually completed it to this day. There was a false report, a scam report a couple of years ago. You do the same thing. You'd harvest eggs from some donor, some female donor. You take whoever wants to be cloned, you take some DNA from them, from a cell, stick it in that egg, shock it, electrically shock it, do something to make it think it's now a zygote, put that in another woman, now she's pregnant, allow it to come to term, and you've got a clone of whoever donated the genetic material. Now, that even most scientists are appalled at that sort of technology. They think it's crazy. And that doesn't solve our medicine problem, our therapeutic problem. So there's an egg and maybe like a skin cell you could use for donating. What they want to do is, and they'll call this therapeutic cloning or somatic cell nuclear transfer, because they know people get scared by the word cloning, and they want to hide the fact of what they're really doing. They'll stop that process before you actually stick that egg in a woman. You'll take your egg, you'll harvest an egg, you'll take out its genetic material, find a donor, take that genetic material, stick it in, shock it, get it to the blastocyst stage, at which point you'd implant it normally. And they don't, they harvest it. And now you've got embryonic stem cells that are a genetic match and an immune match to whoever donated that material. So, embryonic stem cells, and if this technology could work, again, the same process. The blastocyst stage, harvest, take the inner cell mass. Now you've got that embryonic stem cell stage, which is a genetic match to whoever donated that original genetic material. And an embryonic stem cell means, theoretically, you've got any cell type you want. Genetic match, immune match. Solved that problem as well. So, just to review the science of adult stem cells and embryonic stem cells, adult stem cells exist to sustain what normally happens in your healthy adult tissues, constant turnover and high turnover tissues, like the blood and the gut and the skin. And because of their purpose, their design purpose, they have a limited use. They only form blood or only form gut or only form skin, and therefore not as therapeutically useful. And embryonic stem cells, because they're designed to make every cell type of your body, and they do during the process of development, have theoretically unlimited potential, unlimited lifespan, because we found some ways to trick them, and if you can do cloning, unlimited therapeutic use. So review the ethics. Adult stem cell research, does it take human life? If you just take a sample from your pelvis, does that take anyone's life? No, unless you have a bad doctor. Is it morally acceptable to use adult stem cells for research? Yes. Does embryonic stem cell research take human life? What if you clone someone? Does that take any human life? Yes. So is it morally acceptable to do embryonic stem cell research or somatic cell nuclear transfer or some sort of cloning to get embryonic stem cells? No. And that's not satisfactory to some people. For some people, that therapeutic potential is just too enticing, too persuasive. And I actually had a professor, the same professor who thought Psalm 51 wasn't talking about life beginning at conception, who said it's morally imperative that we do embryonic stem cell research because we're saving human life. It'd be wrong for us not to do it. And if you see this potential, and if you know someone who's sick, you might be tempted to think the same way. And you might go trolling on the internet to try to figure out how you should think. And you might come across some of my colleagues who will make some statements that sound sort of persuasive. Like my boss had said, I think, on national television. They asked him, when does life begin? Obviously, you have to answer this question if you want to deal with the ethics. And he said, well, I don't know when life begins. Or Barack Obama, when does life begin? Above my pay grade. People don't want to answer this question because it deals with the complex ethics. It may potentially stop them from doing what they want to do. So, what do you do when you hear something persuasive like this? And this is when I need to volunteer to help me answer this question. Anyone? Yes, please come up here. Actually, stand right there. So what do you do? You know when life begins? You can just face that way. You know when life begins? You think you know when life begins at conception because the Bible says so, but you have a sick grandmother who really could use some embryonic stem cells to cure her Alzheimer's. She can't even remember who you are. And so you're on the internet and you find out that someone says, well, we don't know when life begins. Just one verse to tell you that life begins at conception. You're going to base your grandmother's life on one verse. Well, what do you do to answer this question? Well, the way to do it, if you're not sure what to do with the embryonic stage, is to just take and apply that same excuse to the adult. So I've taken out my little pocket knife, and if I start moving in this direction and start waving it rather menacingly, or if I start poking you, what would you do?
Not be happy.
You'd probably try to stop me. Isn't that a little arrogant to tell me that I'm taking your life? It is arrogant to tell me. Would you try to stop me?
Oh, yeah.
Would anyone else try to stop me? Okay, good. You have friends in here. Why? Because you know when life begins. And I'm sure that any one of my colleagues would try to stop me if I tried to point a knife at them, too. Because they know when life begins. You can sit down. Thank you. Yes, give me a hand. People know when life begins. They just don't want to answer that question early on. No one answers this question truthfully. It's just a smokescreen to hide what the answer really is. So if you're confused or you're not emotionally persuaded yet because it's embryonic, it doesn't look like an adult, well, just apply whatever excuse you've found to a healthy adult, and that should answer your question pretty quick. So that's one objection I've heard. Another one, this is I heard from Mitt Romney, and actually this is a very interesting excuse. I should back up and explain in vitro fertilization. So there are some couples who are unable to have children for whatever reason. They just can't have it normally. So they'll try to undergo a process called in vitro fertilization. They'll take some sperm from the man, egg from the woman, and try to achieve conception in the culture dish. And because it's not a fun process to have needles stuck in you and to harvest these cells, they'll fertilize a whole bunch at once or to have them implanted back in. So maybe you'll get like 6 to 10 fertilized embryos. Now, most couples don't want 6 to 10 embryos implanted or even if it's not at once, have that many kids. So let's say they'll have 2. And even, I think, unfortunately, some Christian couples don't quite understand what happens in this process. They'll have 2 implanted, they'll have 2 kids, and they'll say, well, that's enough. We want to stop. Well, now you've got 4 to 8 embryos still in the freezer, and nobody wants them. And what happens to these? Well, they normally get flushed over time. You've got conception. It's a fertilized zygote. You implant it. It's going to make a human being. And these normally get flushed. So some pragmatic politicians and scientists and others say, well, we should use them. You're not going to let them flush, are you? What's the point? You're killing them anyway. So put them to good use. And what's interesting is I think you can predict who's going to say this based on their abortion position. Those who make exceptions in abortion, like to save the life of the mother, will often adopt this position. People you'd expect to be pro-life will succumb to this excuse, which I think just highlights the fact that you can't make exceptions. You don't take life to save it, no matter what the situation is. So what do you do if you come across this on the internet? So I need two more guy volunteers to help me out with this one. Yes, one more guy volunteer. All right. So since you're the bigger guy and probably the stronger, why don't you stand right back here?
He's probably stronger.
Who's stronger? You just got to be able to hold his arms back.
I think I can do that.
Yeah, okay, good. Hold his arms back. So if I had a bigger knife and I started slitting his throat and I got halfway across, how many of you would try to stop me?
Me.
But he's going to die anyway. I got it halfway across the throat. Clearly that's not an excuse. Thank you, you can sit down. That's not an excuse to take someone's life or to finish them off if they're sitting in the freezer and nobody wants them. The first problem is no one's trying to save them. And they should be, because it's human life. It's normally going to get flushed. And so this is really no excuse. Again, you don't know what to do. Just take that persuasive-sounding argument, persuasive because it's in the embryonic context, and apply it to a healthy adult. So I'm going to put my little knife away and go to the third excuse. Like I said, this ethicist I had in class says it's morally imperative that we do embryonic stem cell research because we're saving human life. We can save your grandmother. We can save your mother who has diabetes. So what do you do with this? Again, so I put my little pocket knife away. I just need one more volunteer. Don't worry, I put my little knife away. Anyone else? I need someone with a healthy pancreas. Okay. So go ahead and stand in the front. So we're saving life. So my mother has diabetes, and you told me you had a healthy pancreas. And a little pocket knife isn't going to solve my problem. So here I've got a nice, more surgical tool to help me obtain your pancreas. And of course, you're going to try to stop me. Why? Why are you all going to try to stop me when are you trying to kill my mother? Because she has diabetes? Obviously not, because you all love Jonathan. And you're going to try to stop me, and you're going to try to stop me, because obviously you don't take life to save it. Thank you, you can sit down. So none of these excuses hold any water when you just apply them to the adult. Of course, they don't hold any water in the embryonic context either, because we know what the scripture says. But if it hasn't gotten you emotionally yet, or you're having trouble getting your mind around it, just apply it to the adult. They're moral equivalents. Point it that way. So, stem cell ethics. We've covered adult, we've covered embryonic. If we harvest from the adult, this is obviously acceptable and okay. This is making me nervous. I'm going to walk right into it and harvest my own pancreas. So if we harvest from the adult, this is okay. This is good. We're not taking any life. If we harvest from the embryonic, this is clearly wrong. It's murder, no matter what excuse you come up with. And this is where we get now into the nuances. What if you harvest from the adult, reprogram back to the embryonic stage, and now you have embryonic stem cells? What am I talking about? This is recent technology, just in the last 4 years. So let's say you take a bone marrow sample from someone's pelvis. You stick them in a culture dish. You tell them to start growing. You add a few chemicals, and voila, now you have an embryonic stem cell. You've sort of turned back the clock, so to speak. And in a sense, your cells do this anyways, to form sperm and egg. That's sort of turning back the clock, because you have to start off at the embryonic stage again. And people have found chemical and genetic tricks to be able to do this. This was a really blockbuster finding, unexpected. In a sense, it's not surprising. If you can do cloning, that's the most extreme form of turning back the clock. So to take an adult cell and turn it back to the embryonic stem cell stage, in a sense, this is not too surprising, but it's a huge technological feat. And now you have every cell type you want. heart, pancreas, muscle, blood, sperm and egg if you want. People have done that too, bizarre as that is. Make sperm and egg from an embryo, even though it's never seen the light of day. So is this an ethical solution? A lot of my colleagues, unsaved colleagues, thought this was great because now you didn't have to deal with the ethical issues the pro-lifers raised. And furthermore, this was a huge technological feat, a huge pragmatic advance, because cloning, no one had done it. No one's still done it, as far as I know. It's hard, and so this is much simpler. Does this solve your ethical problem? And this is where we get to the nuances. So let's return to the biology of the blastocyst, which is normally what you harvest from to get embryonic stem cells. Remember, it's a hollow sphere. The outside is the cell layer, and you got this little ball cluster that we call the inner cell mass. And that distinction is critical because the inner cell mass, that little blue ball, is what forms the fetus itself. The reason you can get every cell type you want is because that's what forms every cell type that makes up the fetus. That hollow sphere comes from that single cell stage, but actually it just forms the placenta. And normally when birth happens, out comes the fetus, that's your baby. The afterbirth, the placenta comes out too, and you just discard that, or sometimes it's used for research. So very profoundly different biological fates and moral fates. What difference does this make when it comes to embryonic stem cells? Well, remember, embryonic stem cells are derived from the inner cell mass. Are they the same thing? That's the question. This is where the pro-life community at large and I differ. Most pro-lifers think this is ethical, that they're not the same thing. And there really is no human experiment you can do. You're not going to play with embryos to do an experiment to answer this question. But there is an experiment you can do with mice to answer this. You can do genetic tricks in mice such that you can make a blastocyst without an inner cell mass, basically. And if you stick embryonic stem cells in that hollow blastocyst and put this new blastocyst in another mouse, you'll get a baby mouse that is derived entirely from your embryonic stem cells. So in the mouse, these are functionally equivalent, basically the same thing. So as far as I'm concerned, I think the embryonic stem cell line is equivalent to this inner cell mass, and you haven't solved any ethical problems. Now, I have colleagues who disagree with me on this, good Christians who disagree with me, but I think that's the question you have to answer. I think they are the same, others don't. So there's the process again. What we really want to know, even though we've harvested from the adults, is going back to the embryonic stem cell state creating a new human life? It is a form of cloning, in a sense. You've cloned a genetic match to you, but have you cloned a new human being? So at least you can give a conditional answer. So again, harvest from adult, this is okay. This is no human life is taken. From embryonic, clearly you're taking human life. If you go from adult back to embryonic, it's wrong if you've created a new human life, which I think you have, others don't think so. If you haven't created a new human life, then it is a good and acceptable solution. Now, pragmatically speaking, you may not have to deal with this question. Even though everyone's excited about embryonic stem cells because they can form any tissue, that's also their biggest drawback. That they're not therapeutically useful. Because if you take embryonic stem cells and just inject them into a mouse, they will form a tumor. We call it a teratoma. A teratoma is about the weirdest tumor there is. It's an embryonic type tumor. Because these cells form any tissue, they form a tumor made up of every tissue. Teeth, hair, it's really bizarre and gross. So this is why people aren't excited therapeutically. They have a lot of power. Theoretically, you can make any cell type you want from them. But if you have, let's say, an Alzheimer's patient and you need neurons, and you have embryonic stem cells and you try to make them differentiate into neurons, even if 99% of your transplanted cells are neurons, 99.999% of your transplanted cells are neurons, if you've got a little contamination from embryonic stem cell, you may very well solve the Alzheimer's and give them a tumor. So even from a secular scientific perspective, pragmatically speaking, going all the way back to the embryonic stem cell stage creates new problems. So this isn't technology that's in existence yet. They were working on it in my lab as I left, but this is what you may see in the future. Again, for pragmatic reasons alone, secular scientists are looking at this, but this would really be the ethical solution, I think, to all of our problems. What if you could harvest, again, blood cells or skin cells, stem cells, from an adult, stick them in the culture dish, add a few chemicals, and instead of going all the way back to the embryonic stem cell stage and turning the clock way back, you just went back to a different adult stem cell stage, like a brain stem cell or a neuronal cell. If you could just interconvert adult cells, you're not creating any new human life. You're not creating any ethical dilemmas. This would solve it. And if we can go all the way back, it seems like we should at least be able to go part of the way back. This isn't in existence yet. The field moves so fast, I anticipate that it will be soon. And this clearly solves our problems. So no human life's created. We don't need to worry. So to summarize everything I've said, adult stem cells exist to sustain your high turnover tissue. You have them right now. They're probably dividing right now to sustain your blood cells that are turning over, your skin cells that are turning over, your gut that's turning over. But they have very limited potential and limited use. They've done great things in the clinic, bone marrow transplants and so forth, but there are many tissues that they aren't useful for. Embryonic stem cells theoretically give us access to any cell type we want. Again, there are tumor potential problems that even from a pragmatic perspective make them dangerous, but theoretically they give us any cell type we want, but they take human life and are therefore wrong. Induced pluripotent stem cells solve some of the pragmatic issues. I don't think they really solve the ethical issues. This is the science that is currently in existence, and in the future you might just see this partial reprogramming, which I haven't put on the screen again because it's still a theoretical concept and not a practical one. And to summarize the ethics, harvest from the adult, this is okay. From the embryonic, this is bad and wrong and murder. To go back to the embryonic stem cell state from the adult may very well be creating new human life and be wrong and murder. And all this would be solved if we could just take the adult and go to a different adult stage. So I'll stop there. We've covered a lot of ground, and I'll take questions or go back and review anything that may have been confusing. How long do they exist normally? They normally exist for a very short window because they form other tissues. This is a good question. Right. Right. And in a sense, this has already been done. Not at that stage. So you start with a zygote that's a single cell, then you get 2, then 4, then 8. If you pick a single one of those 8 cells, which they actually do for pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, those 7 cells will regenerate the lost 8th one and form a fetus. Now, what I appreciated about some of my unsaved colleagues is that even one of the guys who was teaching a class raised the question, well, if you can still develop from those 7, and actually what they've also done is taken one of those 7 and formed an embryonic stem cell line. If you can form another embryonic stem cell line and yet still have another fetus from those 7, have you solved your problem or have you created a new one? Have you created a twin? That's the question. Which I think you have, just functionally speaking. I think any time you're creating a new cell line that can create any tissue you want, I mean, what other source can you get any tissue you want except from a healthy adult? So my guess is, and my fear is, you'd be creating a twin if you even harvested a few, because they're all sort of functionally equivalent. You probably could cause them to divide and make a whole new individual, even though it's a clone. So it's a good question. I'm glad you asked it, because they've done it at different stages. And my guess is really all you've done is created a twin whose life you then take, rather than just a few cells. So it's a fine distinction, but a good question. Yeah?
Is it IPS?
IPS, they call it, yeah. Okay, here's the nuance. So, let's see if I can go back to that stage. Partial reprogramming, IPS. Okay, here. Here's the nuance. So you have, at fertilization, you have a single cell that can give rise to everything. That single cell gives rise both to the placenta and to the fetus. And at this blastocyst stage, you already have that placenta-fetus distinction. And what I'm saying is, I think when you create an embryonic stem cell line, you've essentially created a fetus. It doesn't look like the fetus because it's so early, but you've created the fetus part of the blastocyst. You don't have a trophoblast. I'm sorry, you don't have the trophoblast layer. You don't have the sphere part, you just have that ball.
So it would develop,
Right. Yeah, so basically, another way to phrase the question is, what if you could do something bizarre like take an adult cell and make an entire fetus? You couldn't implant a fetus because it would need a placenta to get nutrients from the mother. And so you probably would not get a new individual if you just implant the embryonic stem cells because they need the trophoblast layer, which is effectively the placenta. So I think what you're basically doing is creating a fetus, albeit at a very early stage, without a placenta. It's really bizarre, but I think it's, that's what I'm calling is essentially equivalent.
And that's why some people
think
it is okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm saying, if we could do this and create a baby without a placenta, I think everyone would immediately object and say, no, you've created a new human life. And so I'm saying, we'll just carry that logic consistently back to this stage, and I think it's the same. We should be thinking the same way. Good question. Yes? Yeah. Right. That's a good question. The individual, I think, was Craig Venter, who has a reputation for being a blowhard and full of himself, and this is another example. He was part of the... So a little history on him, and then I'll explain what he did. So our genetic code was decoded around 2001. There was a government project that was doing it slowly and carefully to get the right answer over several years. Well, him and his ego decided he was going to compete and beat the government to it, and he sold himself as this big guy. And so, anyways, he has this history of overselling his science, which is exactly what this is. All he did really was take a cell, remove its genetic material, and put new genetic material on. So that's what cloning is. This is nothing new. Except the DNA he used, he synthesized entirely artificially. And it's a bacteria. And he can do that because, so our genetic code is about 3 billion letters long. And to synthesize that chemically is obviously very laborious and hard and technically challenging. And if you have a little bacteria that's only 1 million letters long, that's a lot easier. You can do that with current technology. So he did. And actually that, just synthesizing an entire genetic code isn't something new either. We've done that with poliovirus. So this is now just taking from the, now instead of having done it for the virus, he did it for a bacteria. But he calls it synthesizing life because he synthesized the genetic material, which, again, the genetic material isn't life. He had to use the whole, he had to put that in an existing cell, which has all the other components needed to express it and make it work and all this other stuff. So, again, he's overselling himself. So if you're the inventor, it's probably not what he says it is. Other questions or clarifications? Yes. Oh, good question. I haven't actually put that on my driver's license, but so I guess effectively no, but maybe I should. Yeah. Yeah. Oh. Okay, so I haven't actually dealt with ethics boards. The interactions I have had, one was in a class where they were teaching us, and they dealt with the ethics of stem cells, and they had a guy on staff who's paid to be an ethicist, which as far as I'm concerned, he's paid to tell people they can do whatever they want. Effectively, that's what he does. There are some other ethical issues where they slow things down, but they hardly ever stop anything. And yeah, pragmatic is the rule. As far as I'm concerned, it's always couched in very intellectual-sounding philosophical language and politically silly. And so I don't know that I knew anyone who would take a stand like this and say, this is wrong. It just, no one's concerned. Yeah. 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 Right. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good question, and I had to deal with that in the stem cell field immediately because I'm doing adult stem cells, but people are always going back and forth and trying to trade information. Well, this is how the adult works. Can we learn clues from the embryonic? Or another form of that question is something else I had to deal with wasn't stem cell per se, but to manipulate, let's say, adult stem cells in the lab genetically usually requires using this other cell line that was derived from an aborted fetus 30 years ago. And everyone does it. For whatever reason, it works really well. And I had to deal with that and say, is it, I was not part of the life and death decision, I would benefit from it, what's the morally acceptable thing to do? So in that situation, I said, no, I think it's a Romans 14 issue. There's no explicit, I'm not partaking of that murder and that sin. So if there's no explicit scripture dealing with it, Romans 14, whatever's not of faith is sin. If you can't do it in good conscience, it's sin for you to do it. If your conscience is clear, then you're free. And I didn't have a clear conscience, so I said I couldn't do it. And I think that same logic applies, this is sort of me just thinking off the cuff, to that idea. At least that's how I had to deal with it literature-wise. I actually had one of the reasons I picked my boss is because he was willing to work with me on this issue. When I was trying to pick a thesis lab, there's another guy who went through all the nuances of this with me. He's like, well, if you were writing a paper, would you cite someone else who did embryonic stem cell research? Or would you have to add a caveat? By the way, I don't agree with this. And we weren't on the same page. He really forced me to think through things that are sticky. And as it turns out, for my thesis work, I don't think I ever had to cite anyone else's research. I would read the papers. I wouldn't use their lines. I wasn't comfortable with, here's something else someone proposed to me. Well, what if you do the adult research and you need embryonic and, well, you just pass the project off to someone else, they do it, give the results back to you, and you continue? Or what if you're in lab over the weekend and you have work to do and someone else is gone and they ask you to take care of their embryonic stem cell lines? I wouldn't do that. So there's all sorts of nuances to that question. You're asking a good one. And probably one of the major rules to apply is that Romans 14 one, the conscience one. There are definitely situations in which I would be accomplice. Like, I'm not going to help someone do embryonic stem cell research. I think I'm therefore an accomplice to that act of murder. And I wouldn't help them with their cell lines. I wouldn't help them with their derivation. And so it's me participating actively, I'm not going to do it. But using what they've done, again, it's like you said, it's a hazy thing. I think you have to be very careful. My approach would be to err on the side of caution rather than the side of freedom. I don't want to be an accomplice to murder for some little small research step in particular. So it's a good question. I don't know that I can give a short answer other than Romans 14 is immediately relevant. Not being an accomplice is immediately relevant. And furthermore, speaking up isn't immediately relevant, too. That's something else I had to think through. Here I'm surrounded by people doing it, and I'm sitting there keeping my mouth shut while these embryos die next to me. What should I be doing? I never actually confronted those professors face-to-face, but it's something I had to think long and hard about. So these are good questions, and if you're dealing with it or anyone else is dealing with this sort of situation, I'm happy to talk with your specific one at length. But it's an important issue that I think Romans 14 is immediately relevant and others. Other questions? Out of time? Okay. Thank you very much.